from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Wharton San Francisco's Executive MBA program, delivering a rigorous academic experience immersed in the unique Bay Area ecosystem and access to a globally connected network. Wharton.upenn.edu. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, as adults across the nation grapple with race, immigration, and religion, we talk to California publishers trying to inject some diversity into the world of children's books.
I always joke that they accidentally let me in. As a radical queer Chicana, I'm not the normal voice you tend to hear.
And we take the stage with young performers who say musical theater doesn't just teach them about singing and acting, but about acceptance.
Different isn't naughty. Different isn't bad. So why should being different make me sad?
Plus, we catch a bus to the California-Oregon border with a group that's revisiting a dark childhood memory, being sent to an internment camp known for incarcerating Japanese Americans who stood up to the government.
The right to protest is a precious American right. It was something that people who were imprisoned in Tule Lake exercised. And because of that, they were punished.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. There's a lot of talk these days among California parents and teachers about empathy and acceptance. On today's show, we're going to meet some kids around the state from very different backgrounds and visit some places that are helping to give them a sense of belonging, to develop their kindness muscle. We start off in San Diego County, where hundreds of young soccer fanatics from around the globe are in training. They're perfecting the art of the back pass, the header, the scissor kick. But as reporter Aaron Siegel McIntyre tells us, soccer is also helping refugee kids feel confident in a time of uncertainty.
Every Sunday morning, a transformation happens here on the basketball courts outside Cajon Valley Middle School. These concrete slabs surrounded by chain-link fence become the hallowed stomping ground for some of the most resilient soccer players ever to set foot in California. Osama Abdulaziz is one of those soccer-obsessed teens. He's 14 now, but he came to California from Iraq when he was 10. And today, he's not thinking about being a refugee. Right now, his mind is on one thing, soccer. He's really, really excited to be playing.
You see that number 11 in the white shirt? Andy, I think he's known for his speed. Fadi, the guy in the red, for his defending. He's fast too. Sires, that huge kid, he's good at everything.
These Sunday morning sessions are pickup games. Boys and girls play together on the same teams. And the kids here are from places like Congo, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Colombia, Syria, and Afghanistan.
Take it out!
A potent blend of sport and study helps these scholar athletes on and off the field through a group called YALA. YALA means let's go in Arabic, and Sarah Cooper is their director.
We use soccer as a hook to entice children to come in and get academic.
Here at YALA, you can't participate in soccer unless you're in mandatory after-school tutoring. Part of that's ESL, and college is the goal. YALA's headquarters are a stucco building in downtown El Cajon that used to house a bank. Through tutoring and soccer, YALA helps immigrant and refugee kids excel emotionally, academically, and of course, on the soccer field. In the 8 years since its founding, it's helped 1,500 kids.
Oh, do you know what this property is called? Commutative property of multiplication.
Each kid coming here after school retrieves a Chromebook laptop, cracks it open, and gets focused. Osama's working on an essay.
A month in, I came to the U.S. I was struggling in school. I didn't speak a lot of English. I had like two friends.
Those two friends, he says, changed his life by introducing him to YALA.
I have a lot of family back in Iraq. The hard thing was when I came here, I didn't have any family. Yellow really blessed me, and I'm thankful for that. I'm very, very thankful for that.
During afternoon study sessions, volunteers float around the room, helping out where needed.
5 times 4 is 20.
Yeah, so then what number is in common?
So this will be 5.
One of the volunteers, Patrick Foley, says he started volunteering as a response to Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric about immigrants.
The campaign of xenophobia and racism was one that I wanted to respond to, and the only thing I could think of to do something constructive was to volunteer here so the students understand that is not my America.
San Diego County's been a hotspot for refugee resettlement for decades. More than 14,000 Iraqi refugees have been resettled here over the last 8 years. It's estimated Iraqi Americans make up a third of El Cajon's population. And about 40% of the scholar athletes at Yala are Iraqi.
What's my password?
Okay, it's in your folder. Can you check your folder, please?
So is Zainab Salih, who supervises tutors here. Many younger kids at Yala, she says, don't remember much about their home countries.
They are American. They have no idea what about Iraq. The old one, yes, they have a story. They still remember the violence, the bombs, the blood. Sometimes when they start talking, you feel the pain in their voice and in their eyes.
Most recently, she says, staff and volunteers at Yala have been wrestling with anti-immigrant rhetoric. But she says,
we gotta believe in our president and try to adapt. Maybe he don't see the good about our faith and our being immigrants right now, but I believe if we approve that, he's going to see the good in us.
Back at the pickup game, Osama says playing soccer at Yala has given him a sense of belonging, and it's taught him about resolving conflict.
We get into arguments, but at the end of the day, it's all competitive, and at the end, we're all one big family. It's like when you play on the same team, that just everything goes away. You automatically unite again. It's amazing. I think soccer is the best way to solve problems.
Maybe our leaders in Washington should pick up some cleats. For the California Report, I'm Erin Siegel McIntyre in El Cajon.
And now let's meet another group of kids dancing and singing their way around an auditorium in Oakland. This week, they've been rehearsing a new musical based on the Magic Treehouse book series for kids. It debuts this weekend at a first-of-its-kind West Coast conference in Sacramento for the smallest musical theater performers. Musicals are in the air. Hamilton on Broadway, La La Land on the big screen. It feels like the genre itself is being rewritten. So reporter Rachel Dornhelm talked to some young performers to learn what's drawing them in.
The kids in the Bay Area Children's Theater belt out their harmonies while waving ribbons high in the air to mimic a foamy sea. Others twirl orange umbrellas in the shape of a giant sun. Then there is Sophia, perched in a makeshift treehouse. I catch up with her later.
When you're 11 and you're doing musical theater, grown-ups maybe sometimes think that when you're younger you don't care as much, but I think that no matter what age you are, you can still put your heart into it.
There is a lot of heart here. It is a rare chance for the students to rehearse with the founder of the Junior Theater Festival West, Tim McDonald, who doles out directions.
And then can you make sure you do no movement on...
But he also encourages their own ideas.
You did that. Okay, good. So, yes.
Can I cross over to her, kind of?
Let's try it. Let's try it. Is that what your body's telling you to
McDonald
do?
McDonald has spent most of his career trying to get students more involved in musicals.
20 years ago, the audiences for musical theater were literally dying out. They were aging out. And young people weren't picking up that torch.
Enter the composer, Stephen Sondheim. Sondheim reasoned that most students only got first-hand experience with complex musical theater productions starting in high school. Sondheim's idea? Creating one-hour versions of shows, tailored to elementary and middle school kids. McDonald was charged with carrying out the initial idea. It's taken off, and now McDonald says his company, iTheatrics, has an audience of about 36 million people a year.
So 3 times as many people who see more than who see a Broadway show are getting their musical theater fix by watching their children perform one of these adaptations. I think that's kind of incredible.
The kids involved seem to find it pretty incredible, too, and empowering.
My name is Sumuk Kutpakar. I'm 13 years old. Right now I'm playing Captain Bones. He's a pirate.
So how do you do? I'm Captain Bones.
He's the dirtiest, scurviest,
most feline pirate.
I like exploring different characters. Each character has a different mood and tone.
And I'll send you to the locker room, Jamie Jones.
I've been bullied a lot during my school. I think drama has helped me. One time I played a bully in a school show. And in that musical, I love the way that when I was bullying the other character, how that character stood up for himself. And that really taught me, like, how somebody else would feel.
His castmate, 14-year-old Jack Stickler, also finds musicals a welcome exercise in empathy.
Last year, we did a show called Honk Junior, and I played the lead. I was the ugly duckling. When I went on stage and performed, I had that feeling where I was just like, I wasn't Jack Stickler anymore. I was like this character, and it was the best feeling ever. I'd be in my room just singing it constantly because I loved it so much.
Different isn't naughty. Different isn't bad. So why should being different make me sad?
It changed my world because everyone was just so supportive, and it was that environment where I really felt a big feeling of belonging.
It's that confidence and support, Stickler says, that he and his fellow performers will be bringing to the Junior Theater Festival West competition this weekend in Sacramento.
We are guests, we are guests.
For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
So we've heard about kids playing soccer or twirling orange umbrellas and belting out tunes as a way of building empathy and community. Now we're going to turn to a more quiet pursuit, reading. Think of the best-known children's books, Matilda, Where the Wild Things Are, or Captain Underpants. They're all by white authors and have white protagonists. KQED arts reporter Cy Musiker explores how a couple of Bay Area-based publishers are working to make Kid Lit much more reflective of diverse families and experiences.
Let's start with story time.
Let everyone blow raspberries like me.
We're at the Diamond Branch of the Oakland Public Library with about 30 little kids and parents, black, white, Latino, Asian American, and Arab American.
Our first book today is called Mr. Tiger Goes Wild.
I have that book.
Children's librarian Miriam Meadow says a big part of her job is finding books that reflect this really diverse neighborhood, because every child, she says, quoting an old publishing ideal, should be able to read books that are both a window on the world and a reflection of their own lives.
That means a great variety of races and religions and sexualities and experiences of disability and so much more.
Do you find enough books that reflect the communities you're serving?
No, never enough. Not yet.
Here's why Meadow says that. More than half of U.S. kids under the age of 5 are children of color. But only about 14% of the kids' books published in 2015 were authored by or featured people of color. Janine McBath is trying to close that gap.
I can attest to the fact that our communities really are hungry for these books.
McBath is the founder of Blood Orange Press, a kids book publisher, and we're in the walk-in closet of her bedroom. That's her office and studio, just a few blocks away from the Diamond Library. She shows me an illustration for one of the 3 books she's published, a story about a Latino transgender boy.
And the author, Lauren Maieno, based the book on her son, who, when he was in preschool, wanted to be a princess for the school parade.
McBath is mixed race, Chinese American on her mom's side, African American on her dad's. Growing up, she loved books, and a few years ago decided to gamble on a long-held dream to be a publisher.
I want to create an institution that embraces our stories and sees them as worthy of being shared.
Macbeth's print runs are tiny, but she's part of a ripple of change in the big ocean of publishing. Across the bay in San Francisco, another ripple. Maya Cristina Gonzalez runs Reflection Press.
I always joke that they accidentally let me in. As a radical queer Chicana, I'm not the normal voice you tend to hear.
Gonzalez reads aloud from her newest book, a kind of self-help primer for kids called When a Bully Becomes President.
A bully is someone who uses their strength or control to frighten someone, especially to force a person to act the way the bully wants. The purpose of bullying is to hurt the heart and spirit, even if the body is not hurt.
These two Bay Area startups don't feel so alone because they're part of We Need Diverse Books, a 2-year-old social media network with more than 30,000 followers. The group provides internships and grants to writers. And just as the Oscars So White social media campaign put pressure on Hollywood, so We Need Diverse Books is pushing major kids' book publishers to diversify.
Finally, people are waking up and realizing that we need to figure this out together.
Phoebe Yeh is a publisher at Crown Books for Younger Readers, part of the giant Random House group. She says books featuring diverse characters will sell, but publishers will have to do their part to market them. Crown just released an anthology edited by We Need Diverse Books president Ellen Oh, with profits going to the group. Phoebe Yeh.
You know, maybe not this year, but in the next few years, I really think the stats are going to look different.
Yeh and others in the kid-lit world say the stakes are very high right now, with a president who they say seems willing to scapegoat groups based on race or religion. It's a concern for Silwan Ali, a 13-year-old in a headscarf who came with her little brother to story time at the Diamond Library.
Yeah, I know Donald Trump. He sometimes, like, really infuriates our feelings.
What do you think it would do if he read some of the books you read about respecting diversity? What would that mean to him?
It would mean to him a lot because he didn't really know what our culture means.
And maybe, Ali says, President Trump would be a different person if he had read books featuring more diverse characters when he was a kid. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
President Trump is still standing behind his executive order banning people from 7 mostly Muslim countries. That order and his talk about a Muslim registry have sparked a lot of opposition, especially here in California. One vocal group, Japanese Americans. Some of them have long memories of being incarcerated during World War II in what were called relocation or internment camps. The executive order authorizing that internment was signed by President Franklin Roosevelt 75 years ago this month. Reporter Lisa Morehouse joined a busload of people traveling to one of those camps, the former Tule Lake Segregation Center, just south of the Oregon border in Modoc County.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Tule Lake pilgrimage.
Good morning.
For the series California Foodways, Lisa tells us how farming was linked to the incarceration of Japanese Americans.
Out the bus window, I can see the sparsely populated Tule Lake Basin. It's mostly dry, dusty land and a few dramatic rock outcroppings, dotted with green, irrigated cropland.
Growing up, nobody in the family really talked much about the camp experience.
Inside the bus, passing a mic from person to person, are survivors of camps like Tule Lake and their children and grandchildren.
It's a continuous learning experience for me and very, very emotional.
When we arrive at the college campus that will be our base for the 4-day pilgrimage, one of the first people I meet is Sacramento resident Richie Fua.
I wanted to see the place for the last time.
Fua's 98 years old and doesn't think he'll make this trip again. He says he can't remember his social security number, but he remembers this.
19949. That was my number. Government gave me 19949. You were more a number than a name.
Before the war, Fua was a farmer. So was now 93-year-old Jim Tanimoto.
My father, he was a rice grower.
And a peach farmer in the Sacramento Valley town of Gridley.
In fact, Japanese Americans grew almost 40% of the vegetables in California before Pearl Harbor. Here's a 1940s-era film from the War Relocation Authority.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone.
Resentment and hysteria grew about anyone of Japanese origin, even though most were American citizens.
But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores.
So all coastal Japanese Americans were ordered onto so-called relocation camps.
We was forced to evacuate in July of 1942, and our first crop of peaches was ready to harvest about a week later.
Luckily, the Tanimoto's neighbors promised to look after their crops, and the family shipped out to the Tule Lake camp. As a high school kid, Tanimoto had hunted for deer up in the Tule Lake Basin. But when he got off the train with hundreds of others, he saw a landscape dominated by blocks of wooden barracks covered in black tar paper.
Rows and rows and rows of these buildings. We were inside the barbed wire fence and the armed guard towers. I might get shot. Hey, I'm an American citizen. Now I'm the one that's being hunted.
Tanimoto and many other once successful farm owners were about to become field workers for the U.S. government.
Hey, I'm very honored to be able to bring you around the camp.
On the pilgrimage, those of us on a tour of the former campsite have to imagine those rows of barracks, long since torn down or moved.
I know I had a question about the farming in the area.
But our guide points out the few remaining buildings and the huge swaths of farmland once worked by over 1,000 Tule Lake prisoners. Most earned $12 a month.
You know, potatoes, carrots, any kind of camp food that had to be stored here. That's what those main storage facilities were for, off to our right.
All 10 incarceration camps had working ag programs, but Tule Lake's was different. Despite the dust, snow, and wind, and a short growing season, the farm was on former lake bed. The rich soil and the expertise of the Japanese American workers produced nearly 30 vegetable crops, plus hogs and chickens, enough to supply mess halls at Tule Lake and other camps.
They knew how to grow things.
To keep some semblance of normalcy, families tried to create special meals. It helped that Lucille Hitomi's brother worked at the camp slaughterhouse.
I don't know if this was legal, but sometimes he would bring bits of meat home. And my mother had brought to camp a hot plate and a frying pan. And then she'd cook the meat in the barrack.
Instead of joining hundreds of others in the mess hall.
I guess it was more like home.
Camp farms were supposed to feed the Japanese American incarcerees, but administrators took produce, grain, and hay harvested by prison labor and sold it on the open market, over 2 million tons of it over 4 years from Tule Lake alone. 1 year after ordering Japanese Americans out of their homes, the government made every adult in every camp fill out a questionnaire. Writer and historian Barbara Takei.
This outrageous questionnaire was used to separate the so-called loyal from the disloyal.
Jim Tanimoto remembers two questions caused the most confusion and anger. Number 27 asked a person's willingness to join the armed forces.
28, it was sort of like a trick question. Would you cut your ties with Japan and the emperor? Well, I'm an American citizen and a Gridley farm boy. I have no ties with Japan, so how was I to answer this question?
Tanimoto and the other young men in his area of camp refused to answer and got arrested and jailed in nearby towns.
I stood on my constitutional right. They can't do this to us.
Additional fences and guard towers went up, and anyone in the whole camp system who didn't give the right answers was sent to the renamed Tule Lake Segregation Center. This was in the 1940s, 2 decades before leaders like Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King Jr. Here's Barbara Takei.
Now, post-civil rights movement, we realize that the right to protest is a precious American right, It was something that people who were imprisoned in Tule Lake exercised, and because of that, they were punished.
By fall 1943, Tule Lake ballooned to nearly 19,000 people, most of them labeled troublemakers. Rations were slimmed, farm workers were pressured to produce, and camp got tense. When a truck accident injured nearly 30 field workers, killing one, workers went on strike. After administrators brought in Japanese Americans from other camps to finish the harvest, more protests erupted around camp.
And that's what caused the camp director to call in a battalion with the tanks rolling in, and the camp was shut down.
Within days, the director declared martial law. This began two tumultuous years at Tule Lake and ended large-scale farming there. Tule Lake Segregation Center closed in the spring of 1946, 6 months after the war ended. 98-year-old Richie Fuo remembers that the farmland he and other Japanese Americans improved got parceled off to veterans returning from war.
So when the soldiers came back and they wanted the farm way, they could homestead that place.
I kind of joked, was any of that land offered to him?
No.
Some former incarcerees returned home and eventually rebuilt successful farming businesses. Not Richie Fuo. His farm was overgrown, all the equipment stolen.
There's no way to express that feeling that when you see the place like that.
By 1960, the number of Japanese American farmers dropped to a quarter of their pre-war presence. It's impossible to measure all the losses to Japanese Americans, to California, to the whole country. But Barbara Takei says, especially now, we must remember
how easily people, because of fear and anger, lose sight of our important national values of justice and rule of law.
Which, she says, we're seeing today with Muslim Americans, refugees, and immigrants.
As though demonizing other people is going to solve our problems.
All we have to do, she says, is look at World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans to see that's not true. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Modoc County.
That story was scored with original music from Takenobu and produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization. And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Katie McMurrin. Meredith Hodenot helped out with research on our story about Tule Lake. The online producer is David Marks. Our interns are Ryan Levy and Sarah Craig. The California Report's senior producer is Victoria Maulione, and our editorial staff includes Chloe Veltman, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.